Welcome to the Eldritch Estate, an establishment dedicated to the bizarre, the dark, and all that is otherworldly. We invite our guests to come and stay a while, to enjoy the haunted hallways, the shrieks of terror and delight, to forget time in our enchantingly disturbing abode. Whether it's for an overnighter or a week-long stay, our hostesses will see to it that you are shocked, horrified, and left morbidly curious about the goings-on here at the estate. Will you take a trip with us? We can't wait for you to see what's in store. Hello, and welcome back to the Eldritch Estate. I'm Dusty.
And I'm Katie.
And we have a cult episode for you today.
He's a cult.
There's also this, like, TikTok or something. There's some kind of what the young folk call a TikTok going around.
Tic-tac.
And it's like, do you want to be a cult leader? Or something like that.
I have not seen these.
I'll have to, like, find it later because it seems relevant to our interests.
True.
This is going to be one of the more well-known cults out there, and it was a really big deal back when it all went down. Today we'll be covering the Branch Davidians, including talking about David Koresh and the famous siege of the compound in Waco, Texas. It's going to be a doozy, folks, so strap in.
Clip-clop, motor truckers.
Alright, so before we can talk about the cult itself, we have to talk about the religion that is based that it based many of its beliefs on. I feel it's important to know the history without going too far into detail. I'm going to try to talk about the specific role that the religion played in the formation of this cult. So, I did not know any of this prior.
Fun fact, I don't either.
The Branch Davidians are part of a larger branch of Christianity stemming from a group that is known as the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
A branch of a branch of a branch.
Yeah, literally. It's like... And that's also part of why they call themselves the Branch Davidians. I'll get into that in a minute.
Oh, God. Like, anybody who names themselves, it's just bad.
So, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is a Protestant Christian denomination. The Seventh-day Adventists are distinguished by their observance of Saturday, which is the seventh day of the week, in Christian and Jewish calendars, as the Sabbath.
What?
They also believe in the second coming, or Advent, of Christ. So, Seventh-day Adventists. One of the co-founders, Ellen G. White, wrote extensively about these beliefs, and her writings are still frequently used and held in very high regard among the church today.
I've never heard the word Advent in that context. I only know it about little Christmas calendars that got, like,
calendar socks
or candy in them.
Exactly. That's also the, term that I have used in that way. I don't know. Like I said, I didn't know any of this before. Because, like, religion is a huge thing to tackle. And even if you're just talking about Christianity, like, there's a lot.
It's a lot.
So, yeah, Seventh-day Adventist Church. Which, I want to be clear, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is not a cult.
Separate.
The Branch Davidians, especially this particular branch that we're going to talk about today, definitely a cult.
You branch off too many times, and it seems like it just kind of automatically turns into a cult.
Yeah. And we were watching Manifest. I know I talked about this in an earlier episode. We haven't been binging it, so we're still watching it. And there's this religion that starts up in the show, and it's just, like, creeping closer and closer to being a cult, and then all of a sudden, he's, like, poisoning the champagne, and there's a bomb going off, and there's a fire, and people are dying, and I was like, and you have officially crossed the line into being a cult. And he's like, don't worry, we will be born again, and I was like, this is a cult. So.
There needs to be, like, a warning siren.
Right, like, at what point do you cross the line between this is a religion, this is okay, everything's fine, or, like, this is a cult?
I mean, I'm sure that line is different for everyone, too.
Okay, this is a quote from Wikipedia. Much of the theology of the Seventh-day Adventist Church corresponds to common evangelical Christian teachings, such as the Trinity and the infallibility of Scripture. Distinctive post-tribulation teachings include the unconscious state of the dead and the doctrine of an investigative judgment. The church is known for its emphasis on diet and health, including adhering to kosher food laws, advocating vegetarianism, and its holistic understanding of the person. It is likewise known for its promotion of religious liberty and its conservative principles and lifestyle.
Word.
The World Church is governed by a general conference of Seventh-day Adventists, with smaller regions administered by divisions, union conferences, and local conferences. The Seventh-day Adventist Church is currently one of the fastest-growing and most widespread churches worldwide, with a worldwide baptized membership of over 21 million people and 25 million adherents. As of May 2007, it was the 12th largest religious body in the world and the 6th largest highly international religious body. End quote.
So I'm going to pause here. I'm just looking at the structure of this. There's the general conference, which is probably like a couple people, which branches into smaller regions administered by divisions, which is like some more people underneath it.
I think I see where this is going.
Am I about to be really offensive?
I don't know. Let's find out.
No, it's definitely going the way I think it's going.
This is an MLM.
It's a multi-level marketing. It's a fucking pyramid.
It's a pyramid scheme.
Yep, that's precisely where I was going with that. Like, there's just a couple people, and then there's, like, double those people, and then there's, like, double those people. And what shape does that make?
Exactly. No, I'm with you. It's a pyramid scheme. But in a way, a lot of things are pyramid schemes.
It's true.
But not like a...
They're not selling you Cutco knives. They're right. The government.
A lot of things are organized like a pyramid. And that's why we have this thing that they talk about called the trickle-down economy that doesn't exist.
I'm good.
Okay, enough about that.
Sorry.
We digress. So, from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, we have some offshoots. One of these was originally known as the Rod, or Shepherd's Rod, and was founded by a man named Victor Hotef. During the 1920s, Victor, a strict Seventh-day Adventist, became a Sabbath school teacher at the Exposition Park Church in Los Angeles. A keen student of the Bible, Hotef began to delve deeply into it and the writings of Ellen G. White. His Bible study classes in the church started lasting longer and became more complex, and they were also attracting larger groups of Adventists every week. His particular focus was the scriptures from Isaiah in chapters 54 through 66, which I looked up, and they're all very, like, hymnals? Like, it's mostly poetry or, like, songs when you look at it.
Okay.
He started to encounter opposition due to his interpretation from the established, or like his difference in interpretation from the established Seventh-day Adventist Church. And eventually, in 1930, Hotef and a large number of his Bible class were disfellowshipped.
Oh.
Which I didn't
learned,
even know
I just
that was a word.
That is.
Yeah, disfellowshipped.
Yeah.
Which is, it's like the longest word I think I've ever typed. I don't know, it's a really long word, you guys.
It is.
Hotef persisted by moving his class of more than 50 students to a large house across the street from the church.
Bitch, fine. I'll start my own church.
I'm taking my ball and I'm going home.
And I'm making my own sport and you can't play it.
And he continued to study and teach there. So in 1942, the Shepherd's Rod officially changed their name to Davidian Seventh-day Adventists, but was still referred to as the Rod by both members and critics. I know, there's a dirty joke in there somewhere.
I'm a child, I'm sorry.
The group was headquartered at a property known as the Mount Carmel Center near Waco, Texas, and reached its peak in the early 1950s with thousands of adherents, before splintering into various factions after Hotef's death in 1955.
So much bad shit happened in Waco, Texas.
Yeah. Okay, I did a little more digging on this because I couldn't figure out exactly why he was disfellowshipped. Like I said, if you look at those chapters in the Book of Isaiah, it seems like it's mostly songs and there's not much to debate. But here's what I guess the church took issue with. Victor Hotef believed that he was a messenger of God, and his followers began to regard him as a prophet. He may have insinuated more than once that the second coming of the prophet would not be Jesus, but perhaps someone else. Hint, hint. Himself. So, yeah, we saw this with the Heaven's Gate cult and Marshall Applewhite. He's, like, touting himself as the next Christ. A tall man, blonde and blue-eyed. And, just like Marshall Applewhite, from Texas.
He's from Texas.
Ladies and gentlemen, the second coming of Christ will be a Texan. So yeah, the Seventh-day Adventist Church didn't really cotton to that, and that's why he was disfellowshipped. So,
bitch, bye.
Not necessarily his interpretation of it, but more him saying, like, I am the second coming of Christ. They didn't really like that. They didn't really vibe with that.
He sounds like a really egotistical frontman.
For sure.
It's like, this is all songs, and I'm going to sing them to you, and they're beautiful, and I'm God because of it, so come play my kickball and not their kickball.
Come and jam with me, man. But also, I'm going to take the solo on this one. Before he died, Hotef published a 172-page document entitled Shepherd's Rod that detailed his ideas for the reformation of the church, including a long list which he titled, and I quote, partial list of abominations.
Just the partial list, just not the partial whole thing. Just in case I want to add something later.
And, like, what a word to use, abominations. Like, what was on this list? Deborah, you can't put those fucking strawberry candies in the candy dish anymore. Nobody likes them. Like,
it's an abomination.
So I don't know, yeah, I don't know exactly what his beef was, but he had 172 pages worth of stuff to say.
Full of hot air.
The Seventh-day Adventist Church eventually went to court with the Davidians over the heresy of Hotef's teachings. It was a tabernacle hearing conducted by the church with their own officials and such, and I won't get into the nitty-gritty of it because it's actually kind of complicated, but they basically decided, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
And then here's another quote from Wikipedia. In 1934 to 1936, the Seventh-day Adventist Church declared the Shepherd's Rod message to be heresy. Today, it continues to identify the Davidian movement as a disloyal, divisive movement. Any member choosing to identify with either the Davidian message or its originator subjects himself, herself to church discipline, up to and including being disfellowshipped.
That sounds like corporate policy.
Yeah.
Like, up to and including termination.
Yeah. Don't associate with the Davidians or you bout to get disfellowshipped.
No fraternization.
Yeah.
It's a hard word.
Don't be fraternizing with the enemies.
No fraternization.
No fraternization. You heard it here first, folks.
Don't do that.
I don't even know how I would make the hashtag for that. No
fraternization.
Hashtag don't fraternization. So, not only Hotef, but all of his followers were no longer welcome in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It's unclear whether Hotef really gave a damn. He seemed to not really care much. Then wrote the following in an article published in the organization's newsletter. This was in July of 1934. And he said, being deprived of all denominational advantages, such as sanitariums, health food factories, printing presses, etc., perhaps it may be necessary for a rural location. I talked about this in the last episode, too. I hate saying the word rural. A rural location for the establishment of a combined unit to assist in carrying the message to the church until the, quote, siege against it shall be successfully culminated in a glorious victory when the seal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. And that's from Isaiah 9:7. This has been suggested by a sister and her husband who have had considerable experience in this line. Therefore, we call the attention of all who are standing in the light to give consideration to such an enterprise. Anyone having knowledge of such a location and the necessary information regarding it, please communicate it to this office. Our prayers for such an undertaking on behalf of God's people will be answered by whatever the results to this call might be.
You got a compound. We need it.
Literally. He was like, you know, we might need someplace kind of out in the country and, you know, people might have a siege against it. Like, he spoke this into existence from the very beginning.
Jesus.
It's weird.
Manifestation is a fucking real thing.
Right? Yeah, so breaking that down, he's talking about he thinks that somebody will come along and lay siege to him and his followers, and that they should have a rural location from which to defend themselves. They want something big and secluded, and they want to develop their own community there. And this is where we see the foundations of what happened at Waco in 1993. Remember, that article was written in 1934.
That's a long time.
Okay, in April of 1935, the group purchased a plot of land totaling 189 acres in the area outside Waco, Texas. They named it the Mount Carmel Center, after the place where Elijah called the Israelites back to worshiping God. In 1937, an additional 186 acres were added.
That's a shit ton.
That's a shitload of land.
That's a lot.
That's, yeah. That's 370 something. 375. I can't math right now. It's late, but
big enough to be a beet farm.
It's a lot. Yeah. Beets. Bears. Battlestar Galactica. All right. Over the next 20 years, a children's school, sanitarium, rest home, vocational and home economics school, and other improvements were established on the property.
Pause. What's a sanitarium?
I think it's a church building.
Because isn't that a Metallica song?
Sanitarium.
I can hear it in my head.
Oh, sanitarium, medical facility for long-term illness, often associated with treatment of tuberculosis before antibiotics. It can also be a resort facility with spa and medical services.
Interesting. Go there if you crazy. Go there if you got TB. Go and there if you need a facial.
Sing about it if your name is James Hetfield. Okay, there was also an extensive farming operation. See, there you go with the beets.
Yep.
With an orchard of approximately 900 trees, dairy cows, and a large vegetable garden. The flagship structure was the multi-level administration building, which housed the main office, additional staff offices, chapel, printing equipment, and Hotef sleeping quarters.
The multi-level administration
building.
It's almost an MLM.
The multi-level marketing administration building. So by 1955, the Davidians were at their largest. They had amassed nearly 100,000 followers.
Fuck.
They were actually in the middle of this huge campaign that involved going door to door to talk with people, and they were selling off parts of their property to help further their goal. Victor Hotef unexpectedly died in February of 1955, like right in the middle of all of this. This huge campaign where they're trying to get more followers, they're even selling off land. And this ultimately left the leadership of the group to his wife, Florence.
Flo.
Yeah. As you may have guessed, this caused a huge rift in the organization. The man who was directly under Hotef, his name was E.T. Wilson, he was ejected from his position and therefore unable to step up and take command of the group. So he was like the second... Yeah, he was the second in command, and so he would have taken over when Hotef died. But instead, they did some wacky-dacky shit.
They fucking yeeted him and were like, here you go, Flo-Flo.
And put his wife in instead, yeah.
Wow.
There was another hearing held during which Florence insisted that her husband had communicated his desire for her to take over for him in the event of his death. Oh. She done took out the life insurance policy on him, is what it sounds like to me.
For real.
She had no proof to back this up, and they had a trial over it, but she was still somehow allowed to be the leader.
Oh!
And then, she made some procedural changes and upped the power of the vice president.
I like the vice president better.
The price is right. Yeah.
Spay and neuter your pets.
So, as you can tell, this would have upset some people.
Yeah. Yeah, especially that dude they just yeeted from his job.
Mm-hmm. They really said bye, Felicia.
Mm-hmm. Yeet!
So, just a few months after all that happens, there's this man named Benjamin Roden, who is also a member of the Davidians, and he claimed that he had been receiving new revelations from God and that he should be the new leader of the group. They were like, Hotef was the second coming of Christ, but he's dead now. And then this guy, Benjamin Roden, comes and he's like, it's me. I'm the one. I'm the second coming
he's
of Christ.
He's over here with
now.
His eyes closed and his fingers on his temples, and he's like, nyang, nyang, nyang. I'm getting a message.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's me.
It's me. Which I don't know how you just, like, I don't know how you have the fucking balls to just be like, hey, I know our leader who we loved and trusted and we were, like, sure that he was going to lead us to, you know, the second coming and salvation. I know he just died, but I'm pretty sure I'm the new Christ now. Like, I can't imagine.
I'm the captain now.
Look at me. Look at me. I'm the captain now. He basically, like I said, he fancied himself the new prophet since Victor had kicked the bucket.
Bitch, I got that new.
He began calling himself the branch.
I'm sorry. We had the rod, now we got the branch.
I couldn't make it through that sentence. And this was after the branch referred to in Isaiah 11:1. Here's that verse in case you're not familiar, because I was definitely not.
Same.
This is after the Davidic dynasty was, quote, cut off to only a stump after their pride and corruption. So the verse goes, and there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of its roots. So yeah.
Oh.
He called himself the branch.
Tell me why I can't unsee trolls in my head.
Oh, branch. I didn't even go there.
My brain's waiting for a poppy.
Branch is Squidward, though.
Oh.
And we are all Squidward.
Yeah, it's true, though.
Yeah. So there you have it. Branch Davidians. That's where that comes from. Rodin called for the Davidians to come to Mount Carmel to hear his message. And then we see yet another big fracture. I know I said I wasn't going to go into too much detail on this, but like, holy shit, you guys, you need to know the background. We have this power struggle between Florence Hotef, who's Victor's wife, who is newly taken over, and Ben Rodin, a.k.a. The Branch.
It sounds like a WWE name.
It really does. Coming to the stage. The Branch.
Chong, chong, chong.
I know that's John Cena's theme, but like... All right, well, we'll put it to you then, audience members. What would be The Branch's opening song? What's his entrance theme? Send us a listener tale.
Do it.
Let us know what you think. So The Branch is trying to take control by proclaiming himself the new Messiah. So you have two leaders, essentially, and this group of people who've just lost their beloved leader. And so they kind of have to decide which way to go. In 1957, so just 2 years later, Florence sold the old Mount Carmel Center and purchased 941 acres near Elk, Texas.
Jesus.
13 miles northeast of Waco.
Damn.
And she named the property New Mount Carmel Center. She had tried to give this prophecy of these apocalyptic events that would take place on or near April 22nd, 1959, and basically nothing fucking happened.
Oh?
So after that, a lot of people lost faith in her and no longer wanted to follow her as the leader. So right after that, she dissolved the Branch Davidians in 1962 and sold all but 77.86 acres of the new Mount Carmel property. That sounds like some fucking contract bullshit.
Uh-huh.
77.86 acres of the, like,
yep.
Bruh.
You're just talking and spitting numbers until you see their eyes glaze over and you can get what you want.
Yep. Sign on the dotted line, please. And then Rodin took possession of New Mount Carmel in 1962 and started to try and purchase those remaining acres, the 77.86. On February 27th, 1973, New Mount Carmel was sold to Benjamin Rodin, Lois Rodin, and their son George Rodin, trustees for the General Association of Branch Davidian Seventh-day Adventists. From this point on, the property was simply known as Mount Carmel. Stay with me, folks, we're getting there.
Woo!
Rodin passed away in 1978, leaving the compound and the organization to... his wife, Lois. So, once again...
This doesn't seem to go well.
Prophet dies. The wife takes over. Then, in 1981, a man named Vernon Howell came to the compound to study biblical prophecy under Lois Rodin. This man would eventually become known as David Koresh.
Why did he change his name?
We're gonna get to that. Basically, the names are made up and the points don't matter. Everyone can just pick their own name.
I still can't hear that phrase without being salty that I just was like, welcome to the Eldritch Estate where...
Yeah. I mean, it do be late when we record, though.
It's true.
Really do. Okay, we're going to talk about the man himself. So we're going to take a brief sidebar here to talk about David Koresh. David Koresh was born Vernon Wayne Howell to his parents Bonnie Sue Clark and Bobby Wayne Howell.
They sound so wholesome.
Yeah, Bonnie Sue and Bobby Wayne. On August 17th, 1959 in Houston, Texas. Bonnie Sue was only 14 years old.
Oh!
And after she became pregnant, her boyfriend, Bobby, had found another teenage girl that suited him better and left her to raise Vernon on her own.
Wow. What a dick. How old was he?
I couldn't find much about that, but I assume he was also quite young, but older than her? I don't know. I really could not find much on Bobby.
That's okay.
So he hadn't even been born yet when his biological father left him, and that's just for starters.
He did him dirty.
After the birth of her child, Bonnie Sue began living with a violent alcoholic, who I also could not really find any information on, other than he was a violent alcoholic.
Well, that's all you need to know, I guess.
In 1963, she left her son to be with this man.
Nope.
And 4-year-old Vernon was placed under the care of his grandmother, Earlene Clark. I really had to, like, Google how to say her name, you guys, because it looks like earline, like the line of your ear, earline, but it's Earlene, sorry, Earlene Clark.
Bro, there's a brand of makeup at my work that I can't say the name right anymore. It's Catrice.
Catrice.
But that word looks like cat rice.
Mmm.
And I can't not say cat rice, it just comes out. It's like Pope Yes instead of Popeyes.
Mmm. I have this with, there's a street that I pass on my drive every morning, and it's called Fence Line, but all of the streets around it have, like, Spanish names, and so one day when I was driving, I was like, Fencelina, and then I was like, what?
And now you can't unhear
it. And now I can't unhear Fencelina. Fence Line.
Fencelina.
Caramba, Fencelina. So he starts living with his grandmother, Earlene. His mother wouldn't return to his life until he was 7 years old.
Wow.
And after she had married a carpenter by the name of Roy Haldeman. I was not able to find whether or not this violent alcoholic was Roy Haldeman. I think that it was not. I think she got away from that guy.
It sounded like two different people, the way I understood it.
So, Bonnie Sue and Roy went on to have a son named Roger in 1966. Vernon eventually met his bio dad when he was 17 years old, though it doesn't say much here about him or how the encounter went. So as you can tell, it wasn't exactly an easy childhood for poor Vernon.
No, his dad left to get cigarettes and never came back before he was even born.
And then his mom was like, I'm gonna go live with this violent alcoholic. You can stay with your grandma for 3 years.
Hopefully Granny was nice.
And then she came back and she was like, this is my new husband and my new baby and, like, hey, how's it going?
I just can't even imagine, like, where it puts you in your head to know that, like, your parent abandoned you but accepted another child.
Yeah.
Like,
and I get that she was really young and probably not ready to raise a child at 14, but, well, not by that point she would have been 18 because he was 4.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it just boggles your mind to think of how this is affecting everyone involved. Not just that child, but her and this new husband, and this new child, and poor grandma. Like,
yep.
You done fucked up everybody's life with this.
Just 4 years later to stroll back in and be like, okay, come home.
I don't even know you at that point. You know what I mean?
Leave me and Granny alone. We were happy, hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah. I imagine that Earlene is lovely just because she has a nice name, but
she sounds like she bakes pies with beautiful crusts.
It's not always true, but
I like to make at least one part of the story rainbows and butterflies, right, though.
Now, as always, we don't use these terrible things that happened to people when they were children as an excuse for their behavior as an adult. It does not negate any evil they've done. It does not absolve them of any wrongdoing.
You grieve the child, though, for sure.
Yeah, it offers perspective as to how they developed and potentially why they turned out the way that they did. Why did they make this decision versus that one?
What made the prefrontal cortex of their brain stop developing, or whatever the fuck?
And, like, the butterfly effect, too, right? Like, nature versus nurture. What was the pivotal point or the decision that made them go, nope, I'm gonna do this?
Yep. Feel bad for the child, don't feel bad for the adult.
Right. We talk about this, like we said, to give you guys that background, but it's never an excuse. Koresh himself described his childhood as very lonely. He was dealing with dyslexia and had, according to him, poor study skills. He was placed in a special education class and nicknamed Vernie by his classmates. He dropped out of Garland High School during his junior year. From here, things really only go from bad to worse. When he was 19 years old, he had an illicit relationship with a 15-year-old girl and got her pregnant. He began attending a Southern Baptist church and claiming that he was a born-again Christian. Not long after this, he joined his mother's denomination, the Seventh-day Adventist Church. He became obsessed with the pastor's daughter, but he knew that she was off-limits.
No.
According to Koresh, he prayed for guidance, and when he opened his eyes, the Bible lay before him, opened to the passage of Isaiah 34:16, which states, quote, "None should want for her mate." Viewing this as a sign from God, he approached the pastor and told him that God wanted his daughter to be Koresh's wife. Of course, the pastor told him where he could shove it.
Yeah.
Despite this, Koresh continued to pursue the girl and was eventually expelled from the congregation.
Because no means no.
Right. You want to talk about a guy that cannot take no for an answer and is just, like, trying to take whatever he thinks he can. Like, I don't know. There's lots of red flags for me.
Yep, it's giving me anxiety.
In 1981, Koresh moved to Waco, Texas. He was 22 years old.
Oh, and he's a fucking child still. Mm-hmm. Jeez.
He traveled to Mount Carmel and began studying biblical prophecy under Lois Roden. He also allegedly had an affair with her. She would have been in her 60s at the time.
I mean, sometimes you gotta get under someone to move up the ladder, I guess?
I don't know. I for real don't know. He would sing and play guitar during church services. He fit in well. It didn't take him long to become a staple in the community.
Because he given her that good nooch.
Mm-hmm. Alright, so we're gonna merge the two timelines here. We have the Mount Carmel Center, which has just suffered the loss of their second coming of Christ.
The second squared.
Yeah. And left Lois Roden, his wife, his widow, in charge. Here comes Vernon Howell, who is not yet going by the name David Koresh, but just for the sake of not confusing the hell out of you guys and myself, I'm going to continue referring to him as David Koresh. He's just arrived, and he's basically a hit with the ladies and everyone else, too. It sounds like.
Because he's selling what he's cooking to these old ladies.
Well, and we hear about this a lot, about these cult leaders having a certain charisma, right? They're very, like, people-pleaser types. Everyone really likes them. They have that magnetic charm. Yeah. So, maybe he was like that. I don't know. I've never met the guy.
Don't sound like I want to.
No. In 1983, just 2 years after moving to Waco, Koresh began to claim that he was receiving prophecies.
He's like, wait a minute, no bitch, I'm the god.
He's like, so is that how you get to the top around here? You guys, I think I'm having a prophecy.
I'm the captain now.
So as with the other leaders of the Branch Davidians, he now decided that he too was a prophet. And obviously, this was in conflict with the current leaders of the group.
I'm sure they were pissed.
Lois Roden, the current leader of the Branch Davidians, had been challenged for her position one other time by her son, George, in 1979. Now, she was in her late 60s and had met Vernon Howell, aka Koresh. They were having an intimate relationship, and Koresh claimed that this, too, was a sign from God. He claimed that God wanted them to have a child together and that the child would be the chosen one.
Remind me, how old is she?
She's in her 60s, late 60s.
Oh. Not to say it can't happen. Not to say that, you know, whatever people choose to live their life, right, do what they're gonna do. But, homie, you're not gonna get a 60-year-old woman pregnant.
Yeah, late 60s, that would put you at a at-risk pregnancy at the very least.
Yep, because at the very anything least. Over 35, they consider you of advanced maternal age.
Mm-hmm.
Or a geriatric pregnancy. Geriatric.
35. Pregnancy.
At 35.
Just putting it out there.
Add 30 years to that, you know?
Hashtag PSA. So now, we have three people that want to lead the group, and they're all interwoven in a really stupid, complex way. I'm gonna lay this out one more time, because I know it's a tangled web that we weave here. You have Lois, the widow of Ben Roden, who originally started the Branch Davidians. You have her son, George, who would presumably be the rightful heir and the next prophet once she passes away. But then, wild card, you've got the new guy from Houston, who's claiming to be a prophet and trying to father a child with Lois, who he says will be the chosen one.
But isn't he the chosen one? You got plot holes in here, man.
Don't be trying to punch logic-shaped holes in this argument, man. It's not gonna work.
Cult logic apparently lines up with cartoon logic, and you just can't.
You just gotta go with it.
Okay.
The target is constantly moving.
It is.
So, of course, George and Koresh start butting heads. In 1983, Lois allows Koresh to begin teaching his own message called The Serpent's Root, which caused controversy in the group. Which, like, why the fuck you call it The Serpent's Root? Typically, in religion, serpents are not regarded in a positive way.
I mean, not even in Harry Potter are they regarded in a positive way.
Word! So, yeah, that was his little class that he did, I guess, his teachings. And then in 1984, Koresh left the compound with his followers to start a new organization of the Branch Davidians. There had been a fire at the compound that consumed a $500,000 administration building and press.
Multi-level administration.
George accused Koresh of starting the fire, but Koresh stated that, quote, no man started that fire, and that it was an act of God.
He didn't start the fire. It was always burning.
Yeah, so there was this fire, and George was like, Koresh, my guy, why did you light the building on fire? And Koresh was like, it was an act of God. Because that's kind of Koresh's go-to line at this point.
This reminds me of that scene in The Office where Ryan lights the trash can on fire.
Ryan started the fire.
No, microwave. Dwight lit the trash can on fire. He lit the microwave on fire.
And then nobody ever let Ryan live it down.
Ever.
So, Rodin then forced Koresh and his followers off the property at gunpoint.
Oh!
Koresh and around 25 of his followers set up camp at Palestine, Texas, 90 miles from Waco, where they lived in rough conditions in buses and tents for the next 2 years.
I don't know, man. I don't think anybody can just convince me to live in a bus.
I don't think I could do it, but there are some more buses involved later on in this story, as we will find.
Okay.
By this point, Howell was calling himself David Koresh, but he wouldn't make it official on any documents until 1990. And he chose the names from biblical stories, of course. The first being King David, and the second, Cyrus, which in the traditional Hebrew would be spelled and pronounced Koresh. So he's tying himself to King David by calling himself David, and he's tying himself to Cyrus by calling himself Koresh. David Koresh.
He's
basically underscoring the fact that he believes himself to be a prophet and that he has ties to the prophecy.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. And again, I'm just dumbstruck by the cojones on this man. Like, I am a descendant of King David. I'm a descendant of Cyrus. I am a prophet. I'm having visions. My union with this woman is going to cause me to birth or have her birth the chosen one. Like, I don't know, man. I roll out of bed in the morning and I'm like, I just want to make it to the end of the day. Like, I'm not
just trying to not quit my job before 9 a.m.
Right. We drink the coffee and then we do the things, you know? I tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen and I pour myself a cup of ambition. And the rest, we're just running on caffeine and hope, man.
Welcome to the Eldritch Estate, where we are big Dolly fans.
Ooh, we love Dolly. In 1984, Koresh also married a 14-year-old girl named Rachel Jones, who then added Koresh to the end of her name.
Oh.
This was only one of many wives that he would have, but it is important because she was the first. He insisted that God had instructed him to marry Rachel. I guess he's done with Lois.
I bet you Lois was pissed, too.
Well, this is not a good time to say this, but the next thing in my notes is,
in
1986, Lois Rodin passed away of breast cancer. So, yeah. This leaves the leadership of the Branch Davidians to her son, George. Rightfully so. That's her son. George and Koresh continue to butt heads, and then in 1987, things came to a head. Even though Rodin was the de facto leader of the group, many felt that the group's true alliances lay with Koresh. So they were basically like, you're not my dad! Like,
you're not my real mom!
They were like, we know you're, like, the leader, but really, he's the captain. Like, that's what they were saying.
Sure. You can be the pilot.
Yeah.
But we're on a ship and he's the captain.
You can be the co-pilot. You can be navigation.
The assistant to the regional manager. This is apparently going to be an office episode in my brain.
You know what? We've done Mean Girls. We've done Shrek. It's apparently time for the office. So, after Lois's passing, many of the exiled Branch Davidians, who had been living in buses and tents and shit, were anxious to know if they could return to Mount Carmel.
Can we come back now that she did?
Literally.
That's terrible.
They weren't sure because they knew that George and Koresh had butted heads so many times, and so they wanted to support Koresh, but they also wanted to go back to the Mount Carmel Center.
They just want to go home.
Okay, now, this is gonna get a little wacky-dacky. Just...
I mean, it's already wacky-dacky. Let's go.
Just bear with me here. In 1987... Rodin exhumed at least one body.
Oh, this was not the turn I was expecting you to take.
From the community cemetery. Rodin said he was just moving the cemetery. I don't have any more information on that. Katie just looked at me like, the fuck? So he claims he was just moving the cemetery. While Koresh claimed that Rodin had issued a challenge to resurrect the body, and that whoever resurrected the body would be the new leader.
What?
You ever say something, and then a second later you're like, did that really just come out of my fucking mouth?
I can't believe I'm stringing these words together in a sentence.
Yeah. And that it's factual. Like, I didn't just make that up. He really said that.
Whoever can make Frankenstein wins. Mm-hmm. Go.
So
make it work.
We've got this dead body here, and if you can make it reanimate, you're the captain. But if I can make it reanimate, I'm the captain. So, Koresh then goes to the authorities to file charges against Rodin for illegally exhuming a corpse.
What?
But was told he would have to show proof, such as a photograph of the corpse.
Oh.
On November 3rd, 1987... Koresh and seven of his followers raided Mount Carmel, equipped with 5 223 caliber semi-automatic rifles, 2 22 caliber rifles,
jeez,
2 12 gauge shotguns, and nearly 400 rounds of ammunition.
They came in hot on the pew pew.
In an apparent attempt to retake the compound. Although his group claimed that it was trying to obtain evidence of Rodin's illegal activities, none of them had a camera on them.
I'm just gonna draw a picture from memory.
That's admissible in court, right?
I think so.
So, Koresh's group was discovered by Rodin, and a gunfight broke out.
Logically.
Fucking shocker, right?
Okay.
When the sheriff arrived, Rodin had already suffered a minor gunshot wound and was pinned down behind a tree. As a result of the incident, Koresh and his followers were charged with attempted murder.
Yep.
Just get ready, you guys. You're not ready.
I'm not.
At the trial, Koresh explained that he went to the Mount Carmel Center to uncover evidence of a criminal disturbance of a corpse by Rodin. Alright, quote from Wikipedia here. Even with all the effort to bring the casket to court, the standing judge refused to use it as evidence for the case. So they wanted to bring the casket to the court.
What the fuck?
Judge Herman Fitz ruled that the courtroom is no place for a casket when defense attorney Gary Coker requested it be used as evidence for the case. During questions about the casket, Rodin admitted to attempting to resurrect Anne Hughes on 3 occasions. The Rodinville 8, is what they were called, Koresh and his 7 followers that went down there, were forced to carry the casket down the street to a van awaiting the body.
So, they tried to bring a dead lady in her casket into the courtroom.
Correct. And the judge was like, no, you can't do that.
No.
And, like, I know she's dead, but this poor lady, like, she can't rest in peace, y'all, because you keep fucking with her. You dug her out of the ground. You're trying to move her. How? Then you say you're going to resurrect her. Then you're trying to take her into the courtroom. Then you walk her down the street to a van.
So are they, like, clipping her to a jump starter? How are they planning on resurrecting this woman?
I don't have information on that. The trial ended with the jury finding Koresh's followers not guilty, but the jury members were unable to agree on a verdict for Koresh himself. His case was eventually judged a mistrial. After he and his followers were acquitted, he invited the prosecutors to Mount Carmel for ice cream.
Is he about to poison them?
I don't know. I think he's really just cuckoo bananas. Like, hey, y'all want to come for some ice cream since you decided I didn't attempt murder just now? Come get some ice cream cones? Like, the fuck?
I didn't do the Frankenstein thing, so you want ice cream?
Yeah.
Okay.
In 1989, George Roden murdered Wayman Dale Adair with an axe blow to the skull after Adair stated his belief that he himself was the true messiah.
No more captains in this ship.
Yep. He said, you're not the fucking captain, and chippity chop.
Was this in your book, With an Axe?
It was... Oh, I don't know. I haven't finished With an Axe.
Okay.
I'll have to look for it. Roden was then deemed insane and submitted to a psychiatric hospital in Big Spring, Texas.
I mean, yep.
Yep.
That tracks.
That happened. Since Roden owed thousands of dollars in unpaid taxes on the Mount Carmel Center, Koresh and his followers were able to raise the money and reclaim the property.
Okay.
Roden continued to harass the Koresh faction by filing legal papers while imprisoned. When Koresh and his followers reclaimed the Mount Carmel Center, they discovered that tenants who had rented from Roden had left behind a meth lab.
Oh!
Which Koresh reported to the local police department and asked to have removed.
Fun fact, you can't just remove a meth lab. It takes, like, years for the chemicals and shit to fucking dissipate.
Oh.
Yep.
So we're watching Manifest. Okay. This keeps coming up, too. And there was a meth lab, and they said that they cleared it all out, and then mysteriously the meth lab explodes. Yeah. And I haven't gotten beyond that episode, so please don't spoil it for me if you have. So yeah, that's interesting, too.
So fun fact, when this neighborhood was first built, there was, like, 3 model houses that were built, and then I think the builder went under or some shit. And then there was squatters that lived in... in the houses. And they squatted the fuck out of that house. And they literally had to, like, demolish and hazmat and shit before they could rebuild.
Wow.
Maybe the cats in this neighborhood are fucking meth cats.
I mean, could be.
It would make sense.
So on May 15th, 1990, Vernon Howell officially submitted legal paperwork for his name to be changed to David Koresh. As I said before, Koresh is the biblical name of Cyrus the Great, a Persian king who is named a messiah for freeing Jews during the Babylonian captivity. His first name, David, symbolized a lineage directly to the biblical king David, from whom the new messiah would descend.
A little narcissistic, but okay.
A lot narcissistic, yeah. So he was basically professing himself to be the spiritual descendant of King David, a messianic figure carrying out a divinely commissioned errand, end quote. On August 28th, he was granted this legal permission and officially became David Koresh.
Gross.
So at this point, we have everything set in place. David Koresh is the leader of the Branch Davidians. They're living in the Mount Carmel Center compound outside Waco, Texas. We are into the 90s, and the impending siege is close at hand.
Okay.
That is where we are going to stop for part one of the Branch Davidians episode. I will upload part two next week. Thank you. Bye.